talk. We have Bernard Bodman. Bernard joined the biomath department last summer, so he's my senior colleague, I think, by a month. And so Bernard did his PhD at the University of Florida, followed by a postdoc at the University of Houston and Princeton, in broad order. Anyhow, and he worked, most recently, he was working on encodings for optical information, so encodings for analog signals, and found some interesting connections between that work and encodings to protect quantum states against noise, and that's what we're going to hear about today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to give this this talk here for this occasion. As you can see on this image here, there's a bridge between the MC building, in particular the Applied Mathematics Department, and the Perimeter Institute, and there are people crossing over. And so recently I started doing that, but I'm not alone. And I think the hope is, I want to point out that they're really very common interests between the two places. And I think there's a mutual benefit that we can have by increasing the interaction. So, you know, there's in a sense, a potential for interaction or interaction potential. And I'm sure you're all very familiar with those words. So it all started, actually, when I was giving a talk at the University of Guelph. David Cribbs, my collaborator in this work, had invited me. And so I was talking about this classical idea of encoding, and we were both wondering, what on earth would the quantum analog of what we're doing here look like? And so today, the results got finished just in time. Today I can show you a little bit of what the quantum analog of that is. And I have to say that a lot of the insights that we gained, I think they were grown from seeds that were planted by one of my mentors, Vernon Paulson, at the University of Houston, whose book you may know on completely bounded maps and operator algebras gets very frequently cited in the quantum computation literature. So I want to say thanks to various people who have contributed to this work. So in particular, Beth Ruskai, who's been a very active critic of our work and helped to improve things, and Cedric Benny. And then for Joseph Emerson, who had the idea for giving this talk, and also for being in the background organizing. And I think Leanne and all the other people who have been, well, who may be sometimes more or less invisible, but it really takes a lot of commitment to get things going. In particular, for example, the reception afterwards that I should remind you of. Okay, so what are we talking about? When I say quantum communication, what that means is I just want to transmit a quantum state from one place to another, or maybe it's just time evolution of the quantum state. And since things are fairly fragile in the quantum regime, I want to do this in a three-step process. So first, I encode the state in some way, then I transmit it, and something can happen in the course of transmission. And then at the end, I decode it and try to read out information. And so this type of setting has actually been thought about for quite a while, and people realize there's something really interesting sometimes that happens if you have particular types of transmissions that interact with your quantum system. Sometimes they leave entire components of your, let's call it, messenger state unchanged, and that's what's called noiseless subsystems or subspaces. So we'll see at least one of those flavors we'll focus on in the fall. And so then people started thinking about, so what are the typical dynamics that would happen for transmitting quantum states in certain environments? And what are the typical interactions, and can I find a niche where my state or a component of my state is untouched and use that for noiseless transmission? And so here you see a long list of people who've all worked in the context of this, starting from A going to Z. And I really can't add very much to what all of these gentlemen here have done in the sense of what they were looking at. which is to a large extent focused on qubits as a basic unit of quantum information. And so what they're what a lot of people have looked at is how can we correct certain errors that happen in terms of the structure given by these qubits, these basic units of quantum information. What we'll do today is we'll look at something slightly different. And this is intrinsically motivated from just geometric or maybe somewhat information theoretic from an information theoretic perspective. So suppose we want to transmit information, or rather quantum information, which means I need a quantum state, and that quantum state lives on a Hilbert space. So all I know for now is, well, there's a Hilbert space. Okay. No qubits. And then, well, suppose, okay, in addition to having a Hilbert space, I have a preferred basis. And now what can happen is, in the course of the transmission, the state that I send across loses its off-diagonal entries. That's what's called decoherence, and people familiar with the physics literature will see that as, the off-diagonal entries are what we see as interference, whereas the diagonal stuff, that it's more or less the classical nature of what's being transmitted. And so let's look at errors that do this, that delete off-diagonal matrices, off-diagonal entries in matrices, and then let's try to figure out, well, is there, in a sense, a minimally invasive error of this type? And can we guard against this type of error? And then we go up a hierarchy, at least one more step, and say, well, what would be the next invasive type of error? And how can we guard optimally against this? And that is, in essence, the core of this talk. So what we want is optimal encoding. And this idea of optimal encoding is, well, if I know that the error is sparse in a certain sense, then what I have to do is I have to spread information so that it will be minimally sensitive. The other thing we'll do is we will not consider anything that tries to figure out what the error was and correct for it. We'll always reconstruct blindly with the same procedure, irrespective of whatever may have happened in the transmission. And as I said before, this is essentially the quantum, analog of some results that are known in classical linear signal transmission. Okay, so, since I said classical, I thought maybe I should start with the classical picture. So here's a tale of King Solomon's messengers. Here he is, and he has a problem, which is, so there are these three scrolls, he's just recently completed a bunch of poems, that he wants to send to the Queen of Sheba. And he has his five very capable messengers right there, and they're all eager to carry the information from him to her. Here we see her. Okay. But here's a problem. So each of these messengers knows one particular path very well. And two of them are really, really exceptional. They have found some way through the mountains to the other side, and they always get through, no matter what they deliver, and he knows that. But the other three guys, or messengers at least, well, they go through some territory here where King Solomon knows there's a tribe that roams around. And this tribe, when it roams around, and suppose it's at a position, one of those, where it crosses the path of the messenger going through, then that messenger could be intercepted. So it could be that if he gives one of the scrolls to one of these messengers here, it could be that the scroll gets lost because the tribe just happens to pop up or the messenger passes by. And so the question is now, what on earth should he do to get the most information to Queen Sheba, the most of his poems? And the answer is, well, King Solomon, he remembers there's an old trick that he's used before. He takes out his sword and he cuts the third scroll into three equal pieces. He gives the two scrolls to the reliable messengers, and then he gives each of the, let's call them noise susceptible messengers, a third of the information. And then he sends them off. And so if this tribe here, it intercepts at most one of those messengers, if it hits one of them, well, okay, here we go, one third is done. But two thirds are going to make it. And so the queen gets either all of the three scrolls, if nothing happens, or two and two thirds scrolls with one interception. So that's not so bad. And so the message, this tale, is in essence that if you want to transmit information as safely as possible, then to minimize the worst case error, so this is what we could think of as optimal, what you want to do is exhaust the noiseless component, the reliable messengers, and then spread the remaining information evenly across the noise susceptible component. And if this is all you're going to take from this talk, then I think that's all right. That's really the essence of what we're going to do in the quantum setting. Okay, now I have to go a little bit into mathematical details. So I still think it may be good to contrast the classical with the quantum, so we'll make this transition gradually. So in the classical sense, when I want to transmit information, I can think of that as transmitting a probability distribution, or in this case, it's a probability distribution on a finite set of d outcomes, and then the distribution is what's called a probability vector. In the quantum analog of this, instead of, well, having a vector, a probability vector, what I have is a non-negative operator, which is trace normalized, and so the eigenvalues of this operator here will be the probabilities. And so now I want to transmit this this quantum state to the other side. And I know that, well, the transmission is somewhat unreliable. So what I want to do, just as the king does, is I want to incorporate redundancy in my transmission. So how am I going to do this? Well, I take the state, which is given on some Hilbert space, and I transform it into another state on a higher dimensional Hilbert space. So this way, if you like, I can spread the information across a larger number of dimensions. And actually, what I want to look at today, is a very special type of this mapping of quantum states, the encoding, if you like. I put the bar fairly high. I want that this is not just something that could be accomplished by a quantum computer, which is something you would need to transmit one state into another. I want that this operation essentially maps the entire algebra of operators on the smaller dimensional Hilbert space into the algebra of operators on the bigger dimensional Hilbert space. And the reason for this is that when I do this encoding, I want to be as faithful as possible. And so I may not just want to be interested in having something that's probability preserving or trace preserving. I also want to have something that preserves the trace of products of operators when I encode them individually. And those products could be two or three or four. So in a sense, what this type of encoding, this algebra embedding does, is it preserves all higher order correlations among states. Okay, and so this is called a C-star algebra monomorphism. You can always think of it as an embedding of some sort of algebras. Okay, and the nice thing is, as I said, so if it preserves the trace of products, so the trace of this thing here, if I take the trace on the left, that will be the same. That means it's a Hilbert-Schmidt isometry, and so if you transmit either states or observables, say, and you take an inner product in either the original form or in the encoded form, it doesn't matter. And so this is what I mean by, well, it's a very faithful way of transforming things. Now, once you're in the bigger dimensional space, something can happen. So the transmission could have errors occurring. And on the classical side, the way to model these errors is by a stochastic matrix. And what that means is if my distribution has a certain probability to end up in outcome say number 5, in the course of the transmission, this outcome could be spread over, you know, the other outcomes. It could erroneously jump around. And so I do this by using this stochastic matrix here to map some distribution over this smeared out distribution. In the quantum setting, you just have to believe me that this is the most general form, that such type of a stochastic matrix would look like. So these operators here, in the context of noisy transmissions, are called noise operators, or sometimes also called, or more generally called, cross operators for a quantum computation. Okay. Now, I said, well, some of the messengers will deliver the message safely. And so what that means is, when I transmit, then maybe I can think of the transmission as being on a bipartite system, on a system with two parts, and one part always gets through and the other part gets corrupted. And so this is what people call a noiseless subsystem, the existence of a noiseless subsystem. So if I have a type of quantum error, which, as you can see here, well, it does something on this part of the tensor product. So this is the idea of a compound system in quantum mechanics. It does something over here, but it leaves the second component invariant. So if something is untouched, then I say that something that is untouched is a noiseless subsystem for this type of quantum error. And the generalized theory of noiseless subsystems has been, I think, presented very nicely in the paper on so-called operator quantum error correction by David Cribbs and others, which in a sense subsumes a lot of the quantum error correction schemes that have been more or less, well, say, available up to this point. Yes?
The last question, the stochastic matrix, in the classical setting, can it always be thought of as a convex combination of permutation matrices, or is it more general than that?
Good question. So, about this, can you get any stochastic matrix out of a convex combination of permutations?
Only if it's doubly stochastic.
That's true, because a permutation is doubly stochastic. Yeah. So that's not the case. Yeah. Thank you. It's always good to have experts in the audience. Okay. And so now we get to the heart of what I want to discuss today. So the theory of noiseless subsystems, the structure theory of it, is, I think, very well developed. But the question is, now suppose we're able to build these machines that do our computations or transmissions, but for some reason they're a little small for our purposes. So that means the Hilbert space that I have at my disposal for transmitting things, maybe the noiseless component of it is not big enough to capture, to contain all the information I want to put through. What am I going to do then? So as you can see here, there's a CM tensor CL. The second component is always what I think of as noiseless. And the first one is affected by the noise in the transmission. So suppose this dimension of the second component is smaller than the dimension of the original Hilbert space containing the state I want to transmit. So somehow I have to entrust some of the information in that state into the first component, to the first component. How am I going to do this? Or is there, in some sense, an optimal way of doing this? So, here's a little busy slide. Let me just point you to the essential parts of it. So suppose we have this type of C-star encoding that I was talking about before, that preserves the entire algebraic structure of quantum states. And suppose I'm mapping into this type of tensor product space that I was talking about, where the first component is the noisy one, the second noiseless one. Then it turns out that the most general form of this type of C star encoding is given by, in some way, by a block matrix structure. So the state gets mapped into a matrix. Each entry in the matrix is another operator that's obtained from sandwiching the original state between these two operators here. And so note that the indices here, of course, are not identical. So this is not quite like these VJs are not cross operators. But as you can see here, they resolve the identity. And so the nice thing is that whenever I look at a phi at this type of C star encoding, then I know there's always a set of V sub J's of these maps here in the background that do the job. And I can characterize the phi in terms of these and vice versa. So from the phi, I could go to these. Or if I have a bunch of V sub J's that satisfy this, and they have a rank at most L, because they map to CL, then I could construct a C star encoding from there. Okay, so this here, a bunch of non-negative operators that sum to the identity is also known as a positive operator valued measure. So we can go back and forth between the phi and factorizations of positive operator valued measures. So since this was fairly abstract, let me just show you how it works with an example. So as I said, I can start with a POVM, the positive operator value measure. I've chosen a really simple example where all of these things are diagonal and they commute. So nothing easier than that. And here's the state that I'm trying to encode. And so once I've factored the A sub J's into the V's, and I apply them in order to get this block matrix out of them, all this does, all the encoding does really, is it copies blocks from the matrix I'm trying to encode to another bigger matrix. So this matrix here lives on the three-dimensional Hilbert space, whereas this operator here, well, it acts on a six-dimensional Hilbert space, right? So we've doubled the dimensions with our encoding. Okay. And so you see, this block here gets copied over there. And the block right next to it gets copied down here. And the funny thing is that if you do this type of copying and this arrangement this way, then you have a map which is positivity preserving and trace preserving. And, well, there's another type of positivity that it also preserves, which I'm not going to go into. But just notice, if I took the trace of this operator here, this is a 1/2. And the trace of this is the sum of all of these. You notice that the W sub 1/1 appears twice, this appears twice, and this appears twice. So all that times 1/2 is the same thing as the original trace. Okay. So that encoding is not so difficult to understand in the more general situation. You can always think of this as still as taking pieces out of a matrix. Okay, here's the third one. So the corners go in the bottom right corner. Okay, now if this is the encoding, then how am I going to get back? And so fortunately, as I said, the encoding preserves this inner product on the space of linear maps of operators on my Hilbert space. And so since it's a Hilbert-Schmidt isometry, it really embeds one thing, the operators on the lower dimensional space into the operators on the higher dimensional space in a length and inner product preserving way. And everyone knows that when you have an isometry, in order to get back to where you came from, all you need to do is take its adjoint. And so that's what we'll do here. So we take the adjoint of this embedding map. So this here is really the adjoint of the mapping. And we get an inverse. So and you see here, well, again, it's fairly easily described in terms of the VIs and VJs. Let me remind you that this matrix M sub IJ, what that was really a V sub I W V sub J star. So that was the encoded state W. And so what happens is that the V sub I star hits the V sub I sum over these indices here, and because they resolve the identity, that gives the identity on the left, the identity on the right, and what you're left with is the state that you started out. So that shows how to do the inverse of the embedded. And once again, in the block picture, here's what happens. So all this rearrangement, the adjoint does is it takes those blocks, the ones that we've produced with the encoding, it reshuffles them, moves them back to where they came, and then it adds them up. And so as you can see, there's a W sub 1, 1 here, 1 here, 1 here, and 1 here. And after moving those blocks into the places where they came, there's 4 copies of a W sub 1, 1 sitting on top of each other. Then here's a 1 half, and there's another 1 half that comes from the V sub J's, which restores the W sub 1, 1 in the top left corner. And this works for every entries of this matrix. Okay, now, well, I wanted to talk about the presence of a noiseless subsystem, right? And in particular, I wanted to talk about errors that happen in the course of the transmission. So the condition we have for the errors is they have to leave the second component of the transmission invariant. So they have to act as the identity on the second component. They can do something else on the first. And then I said, what I really want to look at is things that delete entries in a matrix that are on the off diagonal. And so since I'm looking at a tensor product here, what this really does is this type of transmission error, it would delete entries in a block off diagonal. So for example, if I choose J equal to 1, and this was my encoded state, then I see that what this type of error does is it deletes the entries here and here, and this first block row and the first block column off diagonal. And this is actually, I think, in a strict sense known as decoherence, the loss of off diagonal matrix entries. So here's a physical picture that goes with what's happening here. So here's our encoded state. We try to transmit it, but as it gets transmitted, it hits a macroscopic system. And what this macroscopic system does is it couples to only one entry, to only one basis vector, in the noise susceptible component of your system, and it performs this decoherence. And it does this perfectly, which means the off-diagonal entries are not just suppressed, they're gone, they go to zero. And so, but actually, in practice, this type of effect is observed. Whenever you do that, whenever you couple something to a macroscopic system, there's so many degrees of freedom in the macroscopic system, they absorb any interference term you could come up with very, very quickly. And what this thing then, what the environment retains, is a classical bit of information about what information has been transmitted. This is sort of sketched here by this yes-no dial that moves to either side. But then the whole thing is in a box, which means we don't see where that pointer went, whether it went to yes or to no. And what comes out on the other side now is this partially corrupted state, which has off-diagonal entries that have been deleted. Okay, so this is a simple example of what's called or sometimes called phase damping channel, the phase being the off-diagonal entries. Okay, so now when I talk about optimality, what I really want is I want to figure out what is the worst case situation. So I really want to do a best job in my encoding, so what I can do is I can pick the phi the best way I can. But then suppose there's another side of it that I don't have under control, and that is these channels that I could be looking at. Well, they could be coupling to any of these basis vectors, number j, say, in this compound system that I'm transmitting. And so suppose I really want to guard against the worst case that could happen. And so what I need to figure out is, what is the state that when I put it in, I try to encode it, and what is the error among those errors that I've been considering that will do the worst damage So here you see, this is the difference between the ideal transmission, if you like, and encoding, faulty transmission, and decoding. So that's the error that comes out of applying this transmission channel here. And what we will be looking at is the Hilbert-Schmidt norm of this operator here. And then ask ourselves, among all the J's that I could pick, and then among all the W's that I could pick, when is this Hilbert-Schmidt norm going to be maximized? That's what I want to call the worst case input state, and well, also worst case error. And I should say something about, well, why did we pick the Hilbert-Schmidt norm? Ideally, there would be something that is really motivated from an information theoretic point of view. We're not there yet. We're beginning to think about the appropriate measure for distortion for reconstructed states. But something that the Hilbert-Schmidt norm does very nicely is it measures purity. You know that the Hilbert-Schmidt norm is always less than or equal to 1, and it's equal to 1 if and only if your state is pure. And so if we have a phase damping error of the type that we've seen, it turns out the Hilbert-Schmidt norm can only go down, which means if you had a pure state, what can happen is it can turn into something that's less pure. And so when we bound the worst case error that could occur, what we're really doing is we're bounding the maximal loss of purity for any state that I want to transmit. Okay, so in this sense, I think it is a fairly natural thing to look at. And the other motivation is, well, it's particularly convenient for the geometric picture that we have, where our encoding is a Hilbert-Schmidt isometry. Now, let's go to a more general picture of phase damping. So as I said, I really don't know which of these diagonal, which of these basis elements my transmission channel is going to couple to. So what I have really is a classical system. The classical system rolls the dice. With some unknown probabilities, it gets whichever outcome. That could be J equal to 1, J equal to 2, etc. After you roll the dice, then the classical system attaches to your transmission, and it deletes the off-diagonal entries in this row, or block row, and block column. So now when I try to figure out the worst case scenario, what I really need to do is I need to take all convex combinations of the channels that I've been previously looking at and try to figure out what is the worst case that could ever occur among all of those. Okay, so that's a challenge. So let's look at it here again. So there's now the, if you like, the channel, something you don't have under control. It can pick arbitrarily whatever PJs it wants to choose in order to inflict this damage on your transmission. And then, since you don't know what state you're going to send through, you have to take the worst case among all states and among all these convex combinations of the EJ transmission channels. And so now, what I really want to optimize, and this has been a while, but we finally arrived at the precise statement of the problem, is I want to minimize the worst case error that could occur among all of these possibilities for convex combinations of channels and the states that I'm putting through. So that's the quantity that I have down here. Now, fortunately, there's an answer to this type of optimality. And so this is the brand new result with David Cripps and Bernd Paulsen. So among all these C-star encodings that I've been looking at, and these associated maps, the V sub J's, remember? There was a way to go back and forth between the C-star encoding and these things here, which, when I, in a sense, square them, give me a resolution of the identity. The optimal error suppression is achieved when all of these V sub J's here, when I put them together in this form that gave me the POVM, when all of these give me projections that are uniformly weighted with some, well, number that you could, oh, here it is, you can calculate. So there's a geometric condition for optimality here that pops out of this, this problem. And that is somewhat surprising. That's it. You know, that's the characterization of optimality. I could say maybe just two phrases about why this may make sense. So it turns out that the operator norm of all of these things here gives you, in a sense, an idea of what the worst case state and error will be that you want to transmit. And so think of the operator norms of all of these B sub j stars B sub j as a soup norm. Now what you're trying to minimize is this soup norm, but under the constraint that all of these B sub j star B sub j's have to sum to the identity, so that's something like an L1 constraint. And you know that if you want to minimize the soup norm while keeping the L1 constant, right? You do that by banging down on the function so that it's totally flat. And what it means to be totally flat in this sense here is when the P is a projection. It turns out the proof is not quite as easy as that, but so this is roughly, I think, the intuition.
These projections sum to identity?
Yes, of course, when the K is this number here. So each of these projections is a rank L, right? So take the trace of the sum of all of these. So that's going to be k times, k times, let's see. So there's m projections. They're all rank L. And so when I sum the trace of all of these, the ml is going to cancel, and I'm left with a d. And, well, they're supposed to give me the identity, right? The trace of the identity on a d-dimensional Hilbert space is d. So this is exactly what I want here.
You originally stipulated that vj star vj is equal to identity summed over j.
Summed over j, that's correct. But no one says that these vj star vj's have to be projections.
Right.
They could be any positive operator you want, but as long as their rank is less than or equal to L. Right. Yes. And so we have arrived at, doing the first step in some sense in a hierarchy of optimal encoding. So what I call C star embedding here, what that does is a perfect reconstruction when nothing happens, right? When there's no error in the transmission. And then among all of those, among all the C star embeddings, I'm trying to figure out what are those that are going to do the best when there is this deletion of off-diagonal component in the off-diagonal parts in one row and column of the first component. And we saw that the answer to that is that those are exactly the uniformly weighted projections. Okay. Now the question is, well, what about if you look at a slightly more invasive error? So something that's going to mess up your state a little bit worse. And so, let's just climb up to the next level, which is instead of deleting the one off-diagonal row and column, let me delete two off-diagonal rows and columns, or rather a block of width two in the off-diagonal. So these the noise operators now are obtained by taking these projections here that contain two entries in the basis, my favorite basis, and then I'm deleting what's in that block row and block column with this type of error. So this is the next more invasive error from what I just considered. And again, I have to ask myself, well, what's the worst case transmission? So again, well, I have all of these channels. They're given by a choice of whichever block, off-diagonal block, I'm trying to delete. Then I want to maximize the impact among all probability vectors that are indexed by these two element subsets of the number of rows or columns. And once again, for the worst case, what I'm looking for is something that maximizes the reconstruction error of this composition here over all input states, anything that I would want to transmit, and all these probability distributions on these sets. And then the optimal encoding, again, minimizes the worst case among all of those. So pretty much the same as what we had before, only now the index turns into subsets of the number of basis vectors in the noisy component. And, well, there's another result. So among all C-star encodings that are optimal for the error of minimal impact, so we're in this hierarchy, right? And now we're trying to look for a subset. So suppose we've done the best possible thing we could do for this rank one type error. So what that means is they have to factor these rank L projections in this way. Now, what is the optimal error suppression that I could achieve? And the answer is, what you want to minimize is not the norm of these things, or the sup of this norm here. You want to minimize the operator norm of pair sums of these p's. And again, that's a very geometric condition for optimality here. And so actually, these things have occurred in the literature already. So if you look at a special case, then so if all of these projections that I use or that give me my p over m, if they're all rank 1, then I can think of them in terms of the one-dimensional subspaces they span. And it turns out that the optimal encoding here is achieved by one-dimensional subspaces which have all the same angle between them. So it may not look like it to you, but so the angle between this subspace and this one, the angle between any pair of these is the same because to define the angle between subspaces, I should be able to allow myself to flip the vectors, right? And if I'm allowed to flip vectors, then this angle here and this angle here are actually the same. So that's what I mean by angle between subspaces. And strictly speaking, this is the condition that comes out of the optimality. And so yes, these have been known already in the context of quantum codes, but it was not, I think, not immediately obvious that they would arise in our problem setting too. So that's a nice nice little detail in the setting of optimal encoding.
Could you remind me what M and D are?
So M is the dimension of the noisy component, and D is the dimension of the
original state.
You know what? I think there's a sign mistake. This should be there's no mistake. It turns out that so the construction of these two uniform equiangular frames is not a simple thing. And so, as you can see here, the number of vectors that I have is 5, but they live in a two-dimensional space. As it turns out, for this construction, what I need is that the M is bigger than D. Yeah. So the dimensions of the noisy component has to be bigger than the dimension of the original Hilbert space, which carries the state that I want to transmit.
That's D.
That's D, yes.
Mm-hmm. Right, we're paused here.
Yes.
So under what conditions do you get that the k times pj's are rank 1? You said if k times pj are all rank 1, then what leads to that?
Right. Remember that these k times pj's are the p over m that you get out of the phi, out of the c star encoding. And so what that means is that the cl, the noiseless component in the transmission, is one-dimensional. So in a sense, yeah, it's a trivial situation. But what this shows is that, yeah, this type of optimality condition, you could actually even think about the situation where you do not have anything that would allow you to transmit anything. So the noiseless component could be, as I said, a one-dimensional subsystem. So you can only stick classical information in that. But still, the condition for optimality here gives you something to work with. So that means the impact of any error of the type that we've looked at will be minimized if you choose this type of encoding. And so, well, here's the second step in our hierarchy, which is, so among all of the ones that give me perfect reconstruction when nothing happens, I found the ones that do best when I use this rank one type of deletion error. And then among all of those, I've picked the ones that perform best for rank two deletion errors. And the question is, what's the next step? And we're not there yet. So, which brings me to a summary and output. So you can do a similar type of computations for worst case and encodings for so-called decoherence-free subspaces. So here we looked at the situation of subsystems, which was given by these tensor products. The subspace situation would be where your transmission occurs on a Hilbert space that can be split into a direct sum of two parts, one that's left alone by the noise and the other that's not. And then again, you can ask yourself, what happens if the noiseless subspace is not big enough to keep all the information that I want to transmit, and what's the best thing to do there? And you get entirely analogous results over there. Yes, so here I've only been talking about the idea of just transmitting information. But now you could ask, well, this particular type of C-star encoding, will that be useful to maybe in other contexts? And I think what's interesting is that since you've preserved the entire structure of this C-star algebra that you're encoding, what you can do now is you can do quantum operations in your d-dimensional Hilbert space, or you can do them after the encoding in your bigger dimensional Hilbert space, where you may think you have some robustness that's given to you by this redundancy, which is inherent after the encoding. So the question is there an application to quantum computing? And that's something that I believe is we're thinking about and maybe worthwhile looking into. Then we just saw that, now one could ask what happens for rank three errors, etc. It turns out in the setting of linear transmission of classical signals, there are criteria which you can use to find out whether you're using an optimal encoding. These are graph theoretic ones that we found with Vern Paulsen. And the question is, well, is there an analog of this in the quantum setting too? I would bet a bit of money on that. Things are a little bit more complicated in the quantum setting, so there's still some work to do. And the other thing that one may want to think about is, so far what I said is that there was a preferred basis for the classical system that interacts with my transmitted state. And so for those of you who've seen the usual literature on quantum error correction, so what that means is the interaction algebra is commutative. And one could ask, so well, what happens if you make that non-commutative? And David Bethruskai and I are thinking about that too. I think this is a good place to stop. So I'd be happy to hear or answer any questions you have.
worst case error, right? In practical applications, could it also be important to minimize maybe the average error or something? And would there be an approach that could do something like that?
Yes. So that's a really good remark. What we've done here is, as you stated correctly, is we minimize the worst case error, which is, in a way, a soup norm, right? And you could say, well, what about minimizing LP norms? And it could be an L2 or an L1. Now, it turns out in the classical setting, these results go through for LP, where the P is sufficiently large, which means in typical systems, you know, P greater than 5 or something like that. It's definitely not going to work for P less than 2. We have counterexamples for that. So one could look into this. Now, the problem with that is if you look at an LP norm in the quantum setting, that's a Schaffen-P norm. And if you look at the Hilbert-Schmidt norm, everything's really easy to compute because the Hilbert-Schmidt norm is just, in a way, the norm, the square, or something, right? So that's okay. That's just two factors they're dealing with. Whereas an LP norm, for any P, you have to take the absolute value of an operator and raise it to some P power before you take the trace. And that's a really hairy business. So this is actually the obstacle that we were encountering that we would need to... to jump, you know, in order to get to, say, more information theoretic motivated measures for distortions, such as entropy, right? So if we want to make any progress there, then yes, we do have to know or find out what's happening in the LP case. Yeah, that's a good question.
I have a question. You're characterizing your phasing noise model as being, say, interacting with the classicals measurements.
Yes.
Couldn't it also be understood as, say, you encode a quantum state as a superposition of the eigenstates of some pattern, and then different eigenstates are coupling to the vacuum with different strengths, and so they have different lifetimes, some being very short, and therefore very bad for encoding information.
That's actually a good, I think, yeah, that's a good point. So the reason why I'm saying classical here is because the off-diagonal entries are set to zero, radically deleted. Whereas other people who look into dephasing would maybe look at the situation where you have a state that gets transmitted and you would scale the off-diagonal entries by some factor strictly less than one and so, but you don't really set them to zero. And so what we're looking at is sort of a radical dephasing, but it's sparse in the sense that only one row and column gets deleted, set to zero, right? So I think that's a really good idea for interpretation. So if you have a quantum system and it couples to the environment, and one of the interactions, you know, lives on a very fast time scale, which means it drives down these off-diagonal matrix elements really rapidly, and the other one does the same thing but a lot slower, then this could be an approximation that could be of use there. In fact, I mean, there's also another context that we started thinking about this. So what this setting that we're considering here could be is that you're trying to send a piece of information and someone else tries to listen in and use these projection operators to extract information from your message. But each time the person does this, there's only one classical bit that pops out of that. So the benefit is really minimal, right? There's nothing smaller than the classical bit. So what you're trying to do now is you're trying to make your system resilient against such type of eavesdropping. So I'm not sure whether this has relevance in cryptography, but there is a possibility. So there's all sorts of interpretations of the error model that we've been looking at here that may have relevance in various physical settings.
Well, I think it'd be interesting to understand the relationship between this and the existing results on channel capacities for quantum channels.
Yes, so we need to address the LP behavior before we can start talking about capacities. That's true.
Are there any other questions? Well, in any case, there'll be opportunities to ask the speaker questions at the reception if you're following the talk. So I invite you to move over to the next room and find out what the score of the soccer game was. We could hear it. All right, let's thank the speaker here.